Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymere Church of Christ.
3 through 10, I'll be reading from the New King James Version. And he sought to see who Jesus was, but could not because of the crowd, for he was short of stature. So he ran ahead and climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was going to pass that way. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him and said to him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house. So he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, they all complained, saying, he has gone to be a great guest with a man who is a sinner. Then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor, and if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, because he also is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost.
I hope you've already turned to Luke chapter 19. We're going to be spending most of our time there this morning, as well as Matthew chapter 21. Before we do that, as we think about our theme for the year, being love above all, one of the things we're doing this year is trying each month to commit a passage of Scripture to memory. And so if you would look with me at this month's memory verse, which really functions as the theme for our entire year. If you would read it with me in Matthew 22, beginning in verse 37. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the great and foremost commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and prophets. And so we'll be going through and learning that with our pew packers as well. And so hopefully as a family by the end of the year, we'll have 12 specific passages committed to memory. It wasn't too long ago, just a couple of hundred years ago, when you have a record of an 1884, a young man who passed away, and after his funeral, his parents wanted to establish a memorial for their son. And so what they did is they came to Charles Eliot, who was the president of Harvard. And this was an unpretentious couple that was dressed very plainly, and they sat in his office and they told him, 1884, they wanted to establish a memorial for their son. Eliot took one look at them and decided they probably couldn't afford a memorial that was all that large. And so in sort of a patronizing tone, he said, well, are you thinking of a scholarship? And they said, no, we were thinking of something more substantial, perhaps a building. And he looked at them again and he judged the fact that he didn't think they knew how much money that would cost to establish a memorial as a building. And so he sort of brushed the idea aside as too expensive and dismissed them from his office. It wasn't until the next year he learned that this couple had developed a memorial for their son named Leland Stanford, now known as Stanford University. He took one look at a couple that he didn't think could afford a very large memorial, and he just dismissed them. He was turning his back on, really, a large amount of money. Our eyes can play tricks on us like that. Our eyes can sometimes deceive us. And as we think this morning about what it means to put love above all, specifically as it relates to evangelism, I want to challenge us to think about how we see things. If you wear glasses or contacts, then you're familiar with the feeling you had the first time you put those glasses on. When you got your prescription and you put those on for the first time, can you remember what it was like to see things that had been there all along, but maybe you hadn't noticed them, you couldn't see them clearly? I can still remember the first time I put on a pair of glasses and realized there were a lot of details out there that I'd been missing. There were things from across the room that came into sharp focus. There were leaves and trees that were far away that I could see much more clearly. There's something about putting on that pair of glasses that helps us see things more clearly than we did. And as we look at this passage this morning, I'd like to challenge all of us, as if we're putting on a new pair of glasses, to look at the situation through the eyes of Christ and see, just maybe, if our eyes have deceived us a little bit. Maybe they've played a trick on us, because we're going to be looking at an individual who was seeking Jesus and Jesus was seeking him. Just a couple of years ago, there was a book published that was titled, an unusual title, The Invisible Gorilla. Christopher Chabry and Daniel Simmons came up with this, and what this has done is pointed to different little experiments you can do and examples of how we have sort of selective attention with what we look at. The Invisible Gorilla is taken from an experiment they did, and you can look up video versions that people have done of this online. But they got a group of people and showed them a video of three individuals who were dressed in white and three individuals who were dressed in black. And both groups were passing a basketball to each other. And what they challenged the viewer to do is to look at both of those groups and to try to keep track of how many times the team in white passes the ball to each other, how many passes they make. And so you're sitting there and you're really intent on trying to keep track of how many times this team has passed the ball back and forth. But what happens is, while you're watching that, there's actually an individual in this video that comes in dressed in a gorilla suit that walks into the middle of these teams that are passing the ball to each other, that sort of waves at the camera, and then walks off. And what's amazing is, if you don't know to look for that, and you're really focused on that team dressed in white that's passing the ball, because of the way our minds work and our eyes work, about half the people that look at that video completely miss someone walking right in the middle in a gorilla suit, waving at the camera, and then walking off. You would think that would be hard to miss. But we tend to see what we're looking for. And it strikes me, as I see the way Jesus looks at others in the Gospels, that oftentimes Jesus is seeing things and looking for things that I might not be looking for if it was just left up to my own personality or my own human nature. He sees things that I miss. And I think that's true when we look at the story of Zacchaeus. As we think about the events in Luke chapter 19, we'll read this text in just a moment, but I'm reminded of a parable that Jesus tells in Matthew chapter 21. He tells a parable about two sons. And as he describes them, beginning in verse 28, he says, "A man had two sons, and he came to the first and said, 'Son, go work today in the vineyard.' And he answered, 'I will not,' but afterward he regretted it and went. The man came to the second and said the same thing, and he answered, 'I will, sir,' but he did not go. And the question Jesus asks in verse 31 is, which of the two did the will of the Father? One said he was going to do it, but then he didn't. One said that he wasn't, and then he ended up doing it after all. And he said, which did the will of his Father? And they replied to him, the first. And then Jesus made an interesting statement. He says, 'Truly I say to you that the tax collectors and prostitutes will get into the kingdom of God before you.' And his reasoning in verse 32, he tells them is, 'For John came to you by way of righteousness, and you did not believe him. But the tax collectors and the prostitutes did believe him. And you, seeing this, did not even feel remorse afterwards so as to believe him.'" Jesus is telling them that when John came, they didn't believe them, but those that had the reputation and the actions and the lifestyle of being sinners did believe him. Because of that, they changed their lives. And even when that happened, these individuals didn't believe in John. And Jesus is saying the same thing is going to be true of his teaching. Now, the reason I think of that parable is because when we come to Luke chapter 19 in Luke's Gospel, Luke 19 and the story of Zacchaeus comes right after what takes place in chapter 18 as a rich young ruler comes to Jesus. So you have a rich young ruler that comes to Jesus and says, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus looks at him and they go over the commandments, and the rich young ruler says, "Well, I've kept all of these from my youth." Jesus said, "There's one thing that's standing in your way." And for that, this rich young ruler, it was his possessions. He says, "If you'll sell all you have and give it to the poor, then you can follow me." This rich young ruler walked away sad. But in the passage that Carl just read for us, we have a tax collector who was living a lifestyle, as we find out later in the text, of a thief. Jesus comes to him. And when this person who hadn't been living the way he should have been living sees Jesus and encounters Jesus, he decides to take drastic action. And he starts giving away his possession. You have one who had lived his lifestyle according to God's commandments, but when he received the challenge from Jesus, he decided to opt out of it and to go another direction. You have another who had been living his life not in a way that was in accordance with God's will, but when he sees Jesus and encounters him, he decides to drastically change his life. One said he was going to do it and didn't. One wasn't, but then decided to obey in a radical way. I think that contrast is insightful. Because after all, Jesus did say that even a group, including tax collectors, would inherit the kingdom of heaven before they would come into the kingdom of God before those who were listening to him in Matthew chapter 21. It's a powerful statement. And we're going to see the way Jesus looked at this situation. Beginning in verse 1, he entered Jericho and was passing through. And there was a man called by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and he was rich. Zacchaeus was trying to see who Jesus was and was unable because of the crowd, for he was small in stature. So he ran on ahead and climbed up in a sycamore tree in order to see him, for he was about to pass through that way. We need to stop right here and just think a little bit about what Luke has already told us about Zacchaeus. There are a couple of things that jump out at us in the text. Number one was not just that he was a tax collector, which already would have been bad enough in the eyes of fellow Jews, but he was a chief tax collector. And so if we think about some of the tax regions of that day where taxes were collected in Capernaum and in Jerusalem and in Jericho, it seems that Zacchaeus is sort of one of the chief tax collectors, if not the chief tax collector of Jericho. He's the one in charge. In other words, there are people who report to him. And not only was he a chief tax collector, but he was also rich. And that's an important detail. Because if you were a tax collector, you were working for the Roman government, the occupiers. In other words, your countrymen weren't going to be very happy with you. You were working for the enemy. But even the way the Romans had designed the tax collecting system, you wouldn't get a lot of wealth. You wouldn't become very wealthy unless you were cheating somewhere along the way. Unless you were charging more than was needed. Or in Zacchaeus' case, if he's a chief tax collector, it may be that he could skim some of the commission off the top of those who were reporting to him. We don't know exactly how he got his wealth, but we do find out later that he was stealing from others. That's one of the statements he makes when he's going to make things right. So these two details are very important because they give us insight into how Zacchaeus would have appeared to others. And then he climbs up this sycamore fig tree, which would not have been something you did in polite society. You didn't just climb up a tree in polite society, but he was desperate enough to see Jesus that he did that. And then we notice Jesus' reaction as he's walking to them in verse 5. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up. He looked up and saw Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus, who desperately wanted to see Jesus, and Jesus was seeking him and said, "Hurry and come down, for today I must stay at your house." Again, when we think of the ancient emphasis in the ancient world on hospitality, this was a very big deal that Jesus, in this big crowd that evidently was so large it was difficult even for those standing outside in the edge of that crowd to see Jesus, in this crowd he chooses Zacchaeus to be the one he's going to come into his home. And so he hurried, came down, received him gladly. And notice what happens in verse 7. This isn't the only time this is going to happen in the text, but they Paul began to grumble, saying, "He's gone to be the guest of a man who is a sinner." I want us to ask a few questions of the text this morning as we think about looking at people the way Jesus looked at people. And number one is, what did they see when they saw Zacchaeus? What did they see when they looked at him? Now, verse 7 gives us a pretty clear example. They said, "He's gone to stay at the house of one who is a sinner." It's pretty clear what they saw when they saw Zacchaeus. We mentioned that as they looked at him, they would have seen a tax collector. And we probably understand why that would have been difficult for them to look at someone who was collecting taxes for the Roman government. And not only that, but someone who had a reputation, evidently, of being one who stole. There are some ancient Jewish writings that describe tax collectors and put them in the same category as robbers and murderers. So just imagine what it would be like to have other people view you in that light as a tax collector. That's the category that Zacchaeus is in here when we read about him being a tax collector. Not only that, but he was a chief tax collector. Some modern authors have tried to come up with a modern parallel of that. And they say it might even be someone who would be a drug dealer. That's the kind of disgust that people would have had when they looked at him. Not only was he a tax collector, but we also see pretty clearly that he would have been considered a traitor. He was working for the Roman government. They were usually considered Jews who had turned their backs on their countrymen. The tax collectors were a constant reminder that the Jews were not in control. And then thirdly, he was a thief. He makes that very clear. Those are the categories. Those are the labels that people would have seen when they looked at Zacchaeus. And it's so easy for us to look at others and to see labels. We look at individuals we know and we know what they've done, and that's the label we put on that person. And if we're not careful, it's hard to see past those labels to what might be underneath the surface. It's hard to look past what we know about that individual to see the potential for change. And so if we know what they saw, we need to ask ourselves the question, what was it that Jesus saw when he looked at Zacchaeus? When Jesus looked at Zacchaeus, he saw something different. He saw very clearly a soul who was searching. I love the way Jesus' mission is described in verse 10 of Luke chapter 19, to seek and to save the lost. Because that tells me that in this passage, Zacchaeus may have been seeking Jesus, but Jesus was seeking him. Why was he seeking him? Because that was part of his mission. If his mission was to seek and save the lost, it was exactly people like Zacchaeus that Jesus was looking for. He was a soul that was seeking, a soul that was searching. I wonder what he knew about Jesus. Have you ever thought to yourself why it was so important for Zacchaeus to see him? Why he wanted to see him so badly? We know Jesus' reputation had likely preceded him, and I wonder what it was exactly that he knew about him. I wonder if he knew what we read a few chapters earlier in Luke chapter 5 and verse 30, that the Pharisees and the scribes were grumbling to Jesus' disciples, asking him, "Why do you eat with tax collectors and sinners?" That this Jewish rabbi, this teacher, had a reputation of spending time and eating with tax collectors. I wonder if he might have known about Matthew, that Matthew was a tax collector and now one of Jesus' apostles. That not only would Jesus allow him to be one of the apostles, but he had changed his life. I wonder if that would have piqued his interest. Verse 1 of Luke chapter 15, right before we read those parables about things that are lost, about the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the lost son, we find those parables are spoken in the context of the fact that tax collectors and sinners were coming near Jesus to hear him and to listen to him. And the Pharisees were grumbling about that. I don't know what it was Zacchaeus knew about Jesus, but he knew there was something there that he needed to see, that he was searching for. And he was desperate enough even to climb up in this tree that probably would have been a sturdy tree, maybe about 30 to 40 feet high, broad branches that are easy to climb. If you were looking for a tree to climb, this would be the one. He was so desperate, though, to see him that he was willing to break the social norms of the time and to climb up there just because he was looking for something. There was something there. I wonder if he was ready for something different. If he was searching for something else, he evidently had a lot of wealth, but that wealth wasn't satisfying him. Maybe he was tired of being hated. Maybe he was tired of others looking at him with disdain. We don't know exactly what it was, but we know there was something in there that was driving him to make this change. And I wonder, too, when Jesus called out his name, I wonder how Zacchaeus reacted. Can you imagine what it would be like to hear your name called out by someone you were trying to see? All of a sudden he calls his name. I just wonder how he would have responded initially. What did he expect? What did he expect this teacher that people were saying was claiming to be the Messiah? What did he expect him to say to him? There's evidently a time lapse in the chapter when Jesus goes into Zacchaeus' home. There evidently is some conversation that takes place. We can assume that because of the way Zacchaeus reacts when he's going to change his life. If you notice, he decided he was going to make a change, and the amount that he was going to give back to the people he had stolen from was more than the highest amount required for restitution in the old law, in the law of Moses. In fact, the amount he's going to give back sounds a lot like this penalty that's described in Acts chapter 22 in verse 1. The penalty for stealing an ox or a sheep, slaughtering it and selling it, You had to give back 5 oxen for the oxen, 4 sheep for the sheep. That's the kind of way Zacchaeus is giving back 4 times what he's taken. That's the standard he's applying to himself. And that becomes even more significant when we think about the fact that John the Baptist, who comes before Jesus and is preaching about repentance, has tax collectors come to him. And when the tax collectors come to John and they say, "What should we do?" His response is, only collect what is required. In other words, don't overcharge. Don't try to cheat people out of their money. John's response is just to change their lives. But Zacchaeus is doing more than that. He takes drastic measures. And we don't get the idea that he's doing that in order to achieve any kind of salvation. We get the idea he's doing that because Jesus looked at him, saw something there, and when he was in the presence of Jesus, he knew he needed to change his life. Whatever teaching and discussion had taken place had convicted Zacchaeus. He wasn't just a soul who was searching. He was a soul who needed salvation. He was a soul who needed something more from life. And as we think about even what Jesus says when he comes into his house in verse 9, "Today salvation has come to this house because he too is a son of Abraham." Someone who had been seen as a tax collector, as a traitor, who worked for the Roman government, he is a son of Abraham. We know what they saw. We know what Jesus saw. But let's bring that to the 21st century and ask ourselves what we see when we look at other people. What do we see? Maybe it's someone at work. And maybe you've known that person a long time. And when you look at that person, what do you see? And it may be that you've thought about bringing up spiritual matters or having a conversation with that individual about Jesus, but you keep thinking to yourself, you know, I've known this person a long time. And it's so easy to see the fact that he's probably not going to change his mind. Her family's always been like that. She's probably not going to change what she believes in. He's always done things this way. There's probably not going to be much of a chance there. So maybe I just ought to look for someone else. I don't know if that's really going to be worth the effort. It's so easy to see what's on the surface. Maybe it's someone you go to school with. And maybe it's a person at school that seems like they have it all together. High school, college, whatever it is. They seem like they've got things all together. They've got plenty of money. They've got plenty of resources. They don't really need anything. They don't look like they need anything. And so there's no reason even to bring up spiritual matters. They look like they have everything under control. You know, it's very likely that someone as wealthy as Zacchaeus might have looked like he had everything under control. People might not have liked him, but he had all kinds of resources. And yet that still wasn't enough. It's a challenge for all of us not to look at what's on the outside, but to look what's below the surface. Jesus does that time and time again. Whether it's a sinful woman that comes to him when he's in a Pharisee's house eating, and she begins to wash his feet with her tears. Whether it's a leper that comes before him, begging him to heal him, and Jesus reaches out and touches someone who would have been considered untouchable in the ancient world. Time and time again, Jesus looks past what's on the outside and looks at what's on the inside. And what happens when we do that, it's not that we condone things that are wrong. It's not that Jesus looked at Zacchaeus and didn't think Zacchaeus needed to make any changes in his life, but he saw the potential for what could be there, and when he did that, then Zacchaeus was willing to change his life. Jesus looked at individuals and saw souls. How would my life be different if I looked at people and didn't see the past things that they'd done, didn't see what labels I might place on them, what category I might put them in, the way that I might categorize them in my life and sort of pigeonhole them with a certain reputation? What if I looked at their souls? If you look at this next picture, you might recognize this issue of Action Comics. Number one, this is the first time Superman was ever introduced to America. Now, I grew up loving comic books, still enjoy watching superhero movies and those kinds of storylines, but this comic book just recently sold at auction. If you had to try and guess how much this sold for, what number would come to mind? Would you believe that this went at auction for over $2 million? The first time a comic book had ever been sold for over $2 million. You can see on the cover, it originally sold for 10 cents, so that's a pretty good investment. You buy something for 10 cents, you wait a while, it's worth $2 million. But my question is this. What makes something like that worth $2 million? Because you can't get near that amount. You can't get near that total. Even if you add up the cost of the paper and the cost of the ink and the wages for the people who wrote it and illustrated and edited it and everything that goes along with that, you still wouldn't get anywhere close to $2 million. So why would it be worth that much? I guess there are different answers, but the simplest explanation, it's worth that much because that's what someone is willing to pay for it. There are individuals out there who are willing to pay that much money for this, and that's why it's worth that much. Value is determined by what individuals are able or willing to pay for something. And the reason that's important is because if I look at other people, and instead of seeing what's on the outside, if I see a soul that God sent His Son into the world to save, that God sent His Son in the world to die, to be buried, to raise from the dead in order to give that soul the chance to live with Him for eternity, if I think of that kind of price, then I'm not looking at someone on the surface level. I'm looking at what they're worth. And God has decided they were worth the sacrifice of His Son. That's a pretty incredible value to put on a human being, on a human soul. How does that change my perspective? It's good news for us because there are some days where we're not going to feel like we're worth very much. There are days where we're going to feel worthless. And we're going to feel like we don't have very much to offer. And we can be reminded of the fact that God sent His Son. That's the price He was willing to pay. But when I think about other people, I'm tempted to write off. I need to remember that person is a soul that Jesus died to save. And so if we think back to our setting at work, that person that's difficult to deal with, I mean really difficult to deal with, that sometimes you go to work and you're just even dreading having to interact with this person because you're not sure how to handle it, that's an individual that Jesus died to save. And when you encounter someone that has very different values than you, has a very different lifestyle than you do, that comes from a different kind of family, that placed an emphasis on different kinds of things, and has so many ways in which you disagree, and so many ways in which you don't match up, that person is the soul for which Jesus died to save. And when you have conflicts with your family, and there's a family member that has said some hurtful things that you just can't seem to forget, and they cut so deeply, it's important to remember that's a soul that Jesus died to save. It changes the way we look at people. If I'm going to love God with all of my being, then I need to see others the way He does. I need to put on a different pair of glasses, look beneath the surface at the potential that's there. What do we see? Jesus told a parable about two sons. One son had said he was going to do what was right, but when the time came, just didn't decide to do it. One had said he wasn't going to, but when the time came, he did make the right decision. Zacchaeus seems to fall in that second category. And as we think about looking at other people, the way we see other people, understanding the value of the soul, it's encouraging for us to ask ourselves that same question. Which category do I fall into? Am I saying I'm going to do one thing, but when the time comes, I'm really not willing to do it? Or do I need to make the kind of decision that Zacchaeus made? Even though maybe in the past I've said I'm going to live my way, I'm going to do things the way I want to do them, do I need to turn my life around? The good news of the gospel is we have that opportunity this morning. If you find yourself in the category of that other son that decided he wasn't going to do what was right, but then had that opportunity to make the right decision. We all have that chance. When we think about the value of the soul, we understand the value that God has placed on us. Those who He created, those whom He sent His Son to die for, and those to whom He's given the chance to have salvation. If you need to make that decision that that other son made in the parable to do what was right, if you need to come forward, turn your life around, put Him on in baptism, if you need to begin that Christian walk, you can do that this morning. Or maybe there's some changes you want to make in your own life. You need to start looking at things differently. Or maybe it's just something we can encourage you with. This is a tremendous resource of brothers and sisters who would love nothing more than to pray with you and to pray for you. If we can help you in any way, please come as we stand, as we sing together.